Okay, let's get started. Is anybody, if any of you are returning the exams, you should do it now. You did two? No. But he really likes it or something. That's it, right? Okay, any questions on the exam? Any comments on the exam? Anything else? Yes. What do I do you have? What solutions? When do you get the results? I hopefully will get them by next Monday, at least in class one. At home one will take even more time. I'll have the solutions by then too. Okay. Let me see. Are there interesting problems here? So what's the thing on k-means clustering? Why can you, how could you be getting different results if you and your friend are doing everything the same? Okay. Different distance measures, that's it. A lot of people, at least in the in-class, said complete link versus single link. It has nothing to do with k-means. Single and complete link are, they are also parameters, but they only make sense when you are comparing the distances between clusters. And you never compare distances between clusters in k-means, you see. I mean, that's not an issue. So the dangling links, what's the problem with the dangling links? No. There is no yes and no. I mean, you're saying if you don't ask the wrong query, then I'll give you the right answer. That's not the way search engine. Anchor text is the major issue. Basically, you could have, even if you have not looked at, in fact, if you read the Google paper, original Google paper, they make a big deal about this. The fact that they have never crawled whitehouse.gov, and yet whitehouse.gov wind up being the first result. Yeah. Well, no. So, the first of all, this is for general search. That was the question. Okay. And also, I should explain to you that this is the reason why I ask for justifications for all the answers. If you say yes or no, you get no points. If you I say this to my kid, you know, if you ask him a long question, you know, how do you think this character is feeling in this Shakespearean tragedy? Yes or no. You know, that's not going to work. I mean, you have to have justification. It was clear. I made it clear. So if you justify your answer, that matters. Okay. So I think in this particular case, I would still say, just in terms of what I asked, I think I was asking for general search. Okay. And there is no real reason why you want to lose the information about that's already available to you. You know, for based on the crawl that you have done, you have some extra information about where useful stuff may be, and it's not really worth throwing it away. Okay. So that's the very interesting thing. So they in the PageRank calculation, oftentimes what they do is they first remove the dangling links, do the calculation, and then bring them back in. But when they're doing it, first of all, the most important thing is this is all for the link analysis, okay? And they're just trying to make the matrix computation faster. But they never remove the anchor text that they gobbled from that, you know, because that's a different issue. This is the adjacency matrix. And you know, for each URL, you actually do have information about its anchor text already kept in. Okay. And in fact, it should affect. I mean, that was, again, I think going back to the the original Google paper. I mean, they never crawled White House, and yet White House is the most important result for Bill Clinton at that particular point of time. Okay, and if you throw that out, then you would get whatever is the second most important result at the top. So you cannot make too much sense of throwing away information that's on the pages. And the magnetic word sets, it's just to make you people realize how silly what we are doing is. You know, I mean, you know, I think we make completely different sentences with the same. I mean, you know, you've seen these magnetic words, right? I mean, especially this guy, what's his name, Joe DiLibero, used to have them when we were in Goldwater, and then, you know, different enterprising kids will come and make different sentences. And what we are saying is they're all saying the exact same thing, in a sense. Okay. And this also actually is an interesting, we were talking about this yesterday for a different reason, and then there's an interesting issue here, which is what is the right level to, so we'll agree that if Google were to index pages in terms of sentences, individual sentences, okay, without knowing the meaning of the sentences, if it actually, for each sentence, that's a dimension. I know that there are way too many of them, but, you know, let's play this game along for a while. Okay, so you have every possible sentence in the world is a separate dimension. And so if you have two copies of that sentence in your paper, you know, in your document, you will get two as the quotient for that particular dimension. Okay, if we did that, then it's great, right? Then you know most of your problems are solved, because then, in essence, you're saying no two documents which don't actually share exact sentences would ever be seen to be similar. Of course, there's the ordering of the sentences even there, but much of the problem of inter-word ordering is taken care of because you're talking in terms of sentences. We don't do it because it's way too costly, way, way too costly. Now, if you're trying to save time and money, I think a much better idea is to index documents in terms of letters that appear in those documents. Way much more interesting. You know, it's really cheap. Only 26 letters if you go with, you know, languages like English. Okay? And that will reduce, that will make sure that each document will be exactly a 26-dimensional vector. And it's a great dimensional reduction idea. We don't do that either. Okay? So why is it that this is the right level? I mean, it's currently the right level. And an interesting point is, I mean, at least just realizing that between the two extremes of sentence level and shingle level indexing and letter level indexing comes the word level indexing, which is, you can see if you're just sitting near them, sit at the word level indexing, you think it's a dumb idea. But you compare it to the sentences, it's much faster, and compare it to the letters, it's like Einstein level idea, you know, because basically the same letters appear in every thing. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I feel like putting different order
sounds good,
but then it gave me different set of
results. Yes. So, because first of all, Google actually does take behind the scenes, it does take into account things like proximity and order. Okay. I mean, vector space doesn't, but Google does. Page rank may not, but Google does. I mean, Google is not using PageRank. If they were, then they should be just as good as everybody else who's using PageRank, and everybody is now using PageRank. They won't call it PageRank, they may call it Yahoo Rank and some other rank. But it's a, you know, it's an idea that's been published, you know. So they clearly have 10,000 exceptions, maybe more, and they won't tell you what are those exceptions. And in particular, if they want to get rid of a page form, you think they will keep using the PageRank just because they wrote a paper in 98 saying they would use it, you know. So it's like there's a lot more that happens behind the scenes than the papers tell you. But, you know, conceptually, vector space similarity doesn't take order into account. Okay. And a variation of order is proximity, in fact, right, in terms of how close are you. And it was known to us that Google does take, even in 98, they were basically talking about taking proximity into account. Okay. Yeah, so the prefix, when is the highest precision, it's not at zero, because I did say an unempty sequence. And why, when it's the highest recall, just keep talking. If you want to increase your recall, you know, keep as give as many results as you can, you know, because you can only improve. Recall can only improve. Precision can go down if you keep talking. And so you want to talk less. Yes. At the recall, yes, I understand. But even if you did not stop, it would still be the same recall. Recall won't change. You may as well have stopped there, but it wouldn't have worsened afterwards. In fact, somebody, at least in the in-class version, wrote, you know, on the off chance that we may get that missing document, because there's one document that's still missing. You know, it's not there in the top 10. So I'll just keep returning. You know, they just decided that they won't care about 10 anymore. They'll keep returning until they increase the probability that they sent all the 6 back. That's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Although I did say, assuming that you go all the way up to 10. Inverted indices, what are the advantages of inverted indices? What? Yeah, what else? Anything else? Yeah, that's the major computation advantage. So, any other advantages? How many of you said space is somehow an advantage for inverted indices? I do know a lot of you. I mean, don't show my hand. I think it's too embarrassing. But space has nothing to do with it. In fact, doing inverted index, if you were going to just do 2 queries in your life, okay, that's it. You know, you just do 2 queries and you shut down the search engine. Okay, I would not do inverted indexing. Because inverted indexing is one of these ideas like sorting, which has to pay for its worth by amortizing the cost over many, many, many queries. In fact, you increase the space. You have an index. Before, you never had an index. You know, now you have to put the inverted index. Okay? And you spend time constructing the inverted index. And that cost is amortized over all the future queries because, you know, every query would have had to go through the entire database before. And when you're computing the inverted index, you did go through the entire database. That's what you did. But you did it once so that future generations can live happily. And so it's an amortization argument for any indexing scheme. Similar pages. What would the easiest way Google might be doing similar pages? Some people, again, I don't know what you guys wrote here, but you know, I have seen some of the ones in the in-class answers. Some people have written things like Google might be doing scalar clustering and stuff like that. You know, it's okay, but it's too costly. You know, it seems to be a much, much simpler idea is what? Exactly. Just send the document as a search query. Relevance feedback. Okay, take whatever you have in front of you and just send that as a search query. Okay, the cheapest. And of course, in the case of Google, you know, I mean, that might well be what it's doing. I have no real idea as to what it might be doing. There are other things that you could actually do. For example, if they have a global link matrix of some sort, you could actually see what are the ones that are related to this page in a sort of a co-citation sense. Okay, but those all assume that you have done that analysis upfront. If you start doing it, you're going to take a long time. Okay, I think the simplest answer would be just relevance feedback. Yes?
An interesting thought about that is that normally Google only allows you to have 10
words. That's for you.
For me.
Yeah.
But then
they can be doing anything they want.
They can do anything they want.
They want, exactly.
That would be a way for you to be able to introduce a lot more terms.
Yeah, that's the, again, this is basically, this is based on the hypothesis that Google is doing it this way. You have now come up with a way to defeat it. And then you can now check whether that is the case or not. That's a good way. I mean, that's basically what we do with when you're kids. You know, we make a hypothesis about how the world works, do a couple of experiments, get burnt, and then change the hypothesis. Yes. How about LSI for the, you know, basically the question is one of time. You know, I mean, what's the easiest thing that they might be doing? There are many of these are reasonable answers, but I think you also have to presumably if you clicked ever, you know, the similar pages thing, you know, it does come back just almost as instantaneously as it does for the normal.
What's the computation?
Yeah.
Like doing indexing.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, if you did the clustering up front, but then if they have clusters, why are they bothering you with individual pages to begin with? If they really had done global clustering of any kind, why should they be bothering you with individual pages as top 10 instead of doing what Vivissimo does? What? Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, no, you're contradicting yourself. You're saying, I am related to this guy, but I won't tell you this upfront because I don't know what the query is going to be. But the moment you're interested in it, you're anyway taking the entire cluster. So. Possible. I mean, again, I think these are all reasonable answers. You know, I think they actually can do much simpler thing than this. Okay, what is it? If they don't really want to send the entire document back, what? Not even the title. Whatever you saw is what they'll send back. See, you are clicking on the similar pages using the top 10 list. Okay, you haven't seen the entire file, right? Use what you have, use the knowledge about what the user is seeing. User has seen the snippet that they made. So now they can bootstrap on that and they say, hey, look, he likes the snippet. So let's just take the snippet as the new query and send it. You don't have to send the entire document. You know, that could take care of that problem. Because presumably if you like it, it's like you like it because of the snippet. You know, it's like you like the movie by looking at the trailer. That's because they always show all the good stuff in the trailer and you actually get the movie. There's no anymore. That's the only thing. That's it. In fact, apparently they make trailers which don't, I mean, have you seen this entire philosophy of trailers? The directors don't make trailers for the movies. There are separate people who make trailers for the movies and whose job it is to get people to, you know, plunk the $6 or $3 and get the DVD or the movie. And then trailers sometimes can have stuff, which I was very surprised to hear, which are not there in the movie anymore. Okay, so, and you know, the snippet is the trailer and you like the trailer. So they can just use that as capturing your interest. Okay, what else is there in this? Digits.com is reasonably easy, right? That's it. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay. So, what we were doing last class is basically, I mean the last class before the exam, was talking about why we should be interested in databases at all. And also we did some very quick, brief, fast review of databases. But that was okay, presumably, because all of you know databases already. And so there were a bunch of directions that we were going to look at in terms of the connection between web and databases. And one of which is, I mean, there were three things that we were talking about at least at that time. One is how databases have to be changed because they are living on the web. And the other is how search has to be changed because databases are masquerading as pages on the web. And the third is how to somehow change the web itself such that the advantages people had because databases have structure could somehow be transferred to text search, which is basically talking about somehow getting the advantages of structured search to web pages. Okay. In essence, for the rest of the semester, we'll be talking basically pieces of all those three problems. Okay. And unlike the first part where basically we were dependent on completely rock solid and probably almost mature fields which were helping us, such as information retrieval and machine learning and, you know, classification and clustering, this stuff that we're going to talk about for the rest of this semester, it's even closer to you know, closer to the edge. So I could be saying things which would be wrong next year. Whereas the first part, I could be saying things that are probably going to be wrong in 2 years from now, but not next year. Okay. So we are much closer to the bleeding edge in this part. And so what I would do is, in no particular order, I will start with talking about how to XML, which is basically winds up being useful for several reasons. You could think of, from our point of view, you could think of how to represent and reason with semi-structured data. And I assume a lot of you know a lot about XML. How many of you have learned too much about XML already? Okay, 1, 2, 3. Okay. So we'll, you know, go through this fairly quickly. I'm not actually planning to do too much of this, but there are a couple of interesting points that we should be on the same page about XML. So there are several reasons why it's, you know, XML standards became interesting. The most important for us is from the relational data side. It is structured, but it's too rigid. The structure is too rigid. Okay, so as I was saying last time when I was discussing the database stuff, that if you wanted to have a book with multiple authors where the number of authors is not given to you up front, there is no easy way of writing that in as a table unless you say author attribute is a list attribute. Now, if you do it as a list attribute, you lose a lot of advantages. Okay, so that's one way of doing it. And the other thing, of course, is if there is an optional attribute, so an attribute may be there or may not be there, which is sort of a special case of having multiple authors, okay? Then the way to handle that in relational databases would be to talk about null values. That's sort of seen as an exception rather than the rule. And yet, you may want to be able to say that this single table should contain both books which have 3 authors and books that have 4 authors and books that have 5 authors, okay? And there's no easy way of saying that in database. So from the database side, people were interested in being able to capture somewhat less rigid structure. Okay, that's one side. And from the text side, they were interested in capturing somewhat more structure. Okay, than without being complete databases, is there any middle ground where we can give structure for parts of the pages, but hopefully that would improve the querying. And you know, the classic examples of semi-structured data, even before web came along, are things like email messages. Okay, email messages are transmitted as text, right? But there are fields in that text which should make sense to programs, like your, you know, mail transfer agents and so on. And there are things that don't make sense to the mail transfer agent, but must make sense to only need to make sense to people. So it was a part of the. There's a part of the message which is structured. And then there's a part of the message which is unstructured. Okay, so you would like to be able to capture that. That would be more structured than text, but somewhat less structured than databases. So you could think of XML as trying to talk about syntax for representing data which is semi-structured. Okay, and here are like actually a bunch of reasons which are all like, some of them are orthogonal, but all of them sort of converged on XML. And it's important to know this because what people wind up doing with XML sometimes drives you up the wall. I mean, not everybody is doing, it doesn't look like there's a method to the madness of what people are trying to do with XML. You know, depending on how people came to XML, they have their own specific agenda. So if you're a database guy, you came to XML, you came because it has less structure. So you're much more interested in doing everything that you were doing in SQL, but doing it in XML now. Okay, and if you're a text guy, you came to it because this was more structure, and so you are interested in somehow improving precision, you know, of your queries, because you are now, you know, searching on the XML pages as against web pages, text pages. Okay, so anyway, these were some of the issues. One is web needed a more declarative format. This is another interesting thing. So if you're transferring, even from a database point of view, if you're transferring tables, the tables don't make sense to the other guy unless upfront you transfer the top of the table. You say, here is the attribute list. And then using this attribute list, you start remembering whatever I'm sending as tuples, you know, these are all these tuples actually have these attributes. Okay, so there is no self-description. So that if you give a tuple, it doesn't describe itself. It only makes sense in the context of the top of the table. This looks like a very minor syntactic issue, but if I just get a tuple, you know, I don't know what to do with it. I need to know what was this tuple part of. And in a sense, when you send a tuple in XML, because of tagging, you put the tag. So it becomes actually a more baroque representation for a single tuple. But the advantage of it is when you get it, whoever gets it actually has all the information about what are the attributes and their values. Okay, that's the advantage. Okay, so it's sort of like more declarative. Now, trying to describe the meaning of the data, this was one of the hopes. And we'll see that's not the case. XML does not capture meaning in any sense of the word. You know, if you have any delusions on that, I will give you an example which you will hopefully never forget. You know, at least most of you would never forget. Chinese may forget it, but you'll see why. But we'll get to that in a minute. And then the second point is documents needed a mechanism for extended tags. Basically, you're defining more and more attributes. From the text side, you're saying parts of the text has some structure. I know this part of the structure is section one, this is section two, and so on. And now, as I said, database people needed more intelligence. So these two are basically here, and this is the blue-eyed optimism in the beginning, that somehow if you write XML, web in the XML, then web should mean to programs what it means to people, you know, and that obviously is gobbledygook. Now, you know, there were various expectations as to how everything will become XML, but it's not right now. You know, people still write text pages. But there's an interesting way everything is becoming XML, because most people except me write their web pages using some web page editor. Okay, and so when you store it, the web page editor in essence might be storing it in both text format and an XML format. Now, all you need to do to store something in XML format is begin tag, end tag. The more questions you ask, the more tags there are likely to be. Okay, so one way the program might, you know, find out more tag information is, in essence, like sometimes they ask you questions. So what's the title of the page you're about to make? And you give the title name, the name of the title of the page, then they can store that as title begin, title end. Okay, that's basically what happens. Much of the XML data that's actually stored as, you know, the web pages which also are stored as XML, that's because somebody is writing it down as XML. Okay. Now, the tag names are then decided by that program. That's very important. Okay, there is nothing sacrosanct about the word title begin, title end. You know, some other program might say doc title begin, doc title end. And you and I would say, oh, doc title and title look like the same tag, but your program won't say that. So somebody else has to come back and say title and doc title are the same. Okay, so that's the issue of meaning not being captured. Okay, so that's basically where we are coming. And here is an example. I'm sure you've seen enough of these XML documents, but let me show you a couple of things that we should know. Here is an example of an IMDb review. It has both text and tagged data. One of the nice things about XML is it should allow freeform text to be intermingled with tagged data. Now, in between tags, the data is still text. Okay, it's just that in this particular case, come between here and here, fugitive, comma, the, that's the value of the attribute title. Okay, and here, reviewer begin, reviewer end, that's the value of the attribute reviewer. This is not the value of anything. This is just text. It's just intermingled text. And this is again a rating, a begin, rating, end. Okay, now, an advantage is actually, go ahead, let's do this. And so the review ended, and then they can have multiple reviews written one after other. And what else? They have something about box office, something about show. What else is there? Here is an interesting thing. Show begin year equal to 1994, and then title begin, and then so on. So one interesting thing, of course, is to realize that these what we were thinking of as attribute names, which are the element names, they are nested. So show is a super element which contains title and seasons. Okay, that's sort of like sections containing subsections, chapters containing sections. So you have that structure. And the second thing here is instead of an element, an element can have properties, attribute values. In fact, these are the XML attribute values. So element show has the property year equal to 1994. Now it turns out that in fact there's this whole issue of you could have written this particular thing as show begin and then year begin, 1994 year end. That's fine. That's another way of representing the same data. So as to what should be represented as an attribute and what should be represented as an element, there is no standards on that. There's no requirement that the things that are represented as attributes can also be represented as elements. So here are some, so the beginning of the tags, the end of the tags, that whole thing is an element, of course, that has a nested element, which is sometimes, and then there is an attribute value, and basically the element has an attribute, and the value of the attribute is also given. And then other interesting thing is mixed content. Okay. All I need you to understand right now is, I mean, there are enough books out there which will give you syntax of XML. I'm not trying to teach you that. Okay, so all I need you to understand here is this is useful for the two things that we set for ourselves. One is you can write text documents, full text documents as XML documents. I can say doc begin, write the entire text, doc end. Okay, I can write database relational tables as XML documents, right? I can say table begin, attribute begin, and then value of the first tuple's attribute one, attribute end, attribute begin, etc. So table begin, tuple begin, and then all the attribute values, tuple end, tuple begin, and continue. That's a reasonable way of representing. So you can capture both the structured and semi-structured, structured and unstructured. And so, since you can capture both, then you have semi-structured data. Okay, so these are all the jargon that you should know: tags, start and end of the tags, elements. Elements can be nested, and you can have an empty element. In fact, one of the interesting things is if you want to just say that this thing is red, you can just say red begin, red end. That's a way to say that this thing is actually red. You know, you can say it that way. Okay. And then so that's your terminology stuff. And as I said, you could have you can have attributes for elements. An interesting issue is the following, even at this level, which is order. Does order matter in an XML? Okay, so for example, if I say section begin and write a section, first section, and say section end, and write section begin again, write the second section and section end, could I then, is that XML file equivalent to another XML file, the second section is the first element and the first section is the second element, is it? No, it has nothing to do with that. It's nothing to do with that. In fact, in a file that I show you, in a text file I show you, I have a bunch of sentences. Are you allowed to change the order of the sentences? If I didn't say this is the first sentence, this is the second sentence, it's implicit that the first sentence is there for a purpose. I wanted it to be the first sentence. You don't get to change it. Okay? So in fact, the answer to my question depends on who you ask it. Okay? Text people, the people who came to XML from the text community, would be flabbergasted if you say, yeah, you know, it doesn't really matter. I'll just change the sections around. I'll change the, you know, nesting inside the anywhere there are a bunch of elements, like, you know, you can just put them in any order. If you say that, text people will basically have nightmares. Now, what about database people? Database people don't care. You know, if you have a table and you have table one, which has this row, second row, and the other table where this row is first and this row is second, they're the same table because they're the same relation, because you use set semantics. So database people would rather say that this has, there should not be any order, in fact. XML should not have any order. And you can see how a nice perfect storm is being, you know, is brewing, right? Because XML, the standard, essentially, the XML standard is only part of the story. The second thing is, how do you query XML? We'll talk about it. You know, in fact, currently there are many, many standards. One, which everybody is hoping will become the, you know, COBOL, no, the PL1 of XML standards is XQuery. Okay, do you know why I said PL1? Does anybody know what PL1 is? PL1 is a programming language, and what was it made up of? It was basically taken from COBOL and Fortran, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, even my memory is fading. I used PL1, so you are seeing, you know, real museum quality person in front of you. And so PL1 actually was invented in some sense by IBM because these business people were writing these really baroque programs, COBOL, which are like talking to each other, you know, in long, long sentences, each sentence, okay? And then the engineering people, the Fortran guys, were writing these things which they would not themselves understand if they read it in the evening, okay? And so IBM said, we need a language where both of them can write the programs. The COBOL guys can write COBOL programs in PL1, Fortran guys can write Fortran programs in PL1. And so PL1 was invented. And you can see how successful it is, given that we are no longer using it. Okay. XQuery is essentially sort of, you know, again, something that people try to do by beating down two different camps. You know, the IR folks who want certain set of querying capabilities on XML, and DB folks who want certain other set of querying capabilities on XML, and they have to come to an agreement. And as late, in fact, the first, I think 2 years back when I taught this course, not the last time, but the year before that, XQuery barely existed. So we used to talk about whatever was the current, hopefully, front runner standard. That was like XML query or something, and which looks suspiciously similar to XQuery, which sort of shows that database guys won the war, the battle at least. I don't know whether they won the war or not. But, you know, so XQuery looks very much, XQuery is currently something that the WWW consortium agreed on, okay? It has everything for everybody. You know, you can do text operations, you can do database operations, and what that means then is that they have to have figured out a way of keeping people who care about order as well as people who don't care about order be happy. So what they did, of course, was they said, you say during your querying whether you care about order or not. Okay? So you write a query saying, I care about order and my query. And then somebody else says, I don't care about order and this is my query. And then they would both have to be supported. The answers are different based on whether you say you care about order or not. Okay, it's a big thing. I mean, it doesn't look like a big thing, but it is a big thing because for database people, shifting around elements doesn't change the semantics of the data. Whereas in text, you shift around elements, that is no longer the same text. Okay. There are other interesting things actually in XML. You have object IDs, and you can refer to objects, pieces of the XML document from other parts of the XML document using the object IDs. So you could say things like cross-referencing, as in section 4, which as we do. Okay, that's actually a nice thing that XML allows. And if you start talking about object IDs, in fact, as you can see, it starts becoming more like object-oriented databases because you now have tuples don't have names in relational databases, whereas objects have identities in object-oriented databases. So this is the moment you have an ID. You're talking about object-oriented. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about syntax of XML. There's a lot more to syntax of XML, but I'm sure either you know a lot more than what I already said, or if you care, you'll read more about it. Okay, let me say a couple more things about how XML and HTML and XML and semantic web, all these things are connected. And then also we'll talk about querying XML. Okay, so first of all, this is a piece of data in HTML format. This is a piece of data, the same piece of data in XML format. In fact, this is also in XML, by the way. Okay. Everything is in XML. If you have tag begin, tag end, it's XML. So that this is HTML, that's XML. So what's the difference in essence? Okay, see, this is a nice way of thinking about it, right? Which is that this is about the content. You know, somebody's view of the content of this data is being delineated by the tags. Okay, and here on the other hand, this is basically the tags that are being used really are instructions to the rendering agent that put this in big letters, put this in small letters, and so on. Okay. So XML, HTML is really a very special case where, you know, all tags are essentially conveying rendering information. They don't really convey any content information. Now, whether or not these convey content information is very much open to question. All we can say is they don't convey rendering information. Okay? They may mean a lot to the guy who wrote these. Okay? They don't mean anything to anybody else, including Internet Explorer. Because which would not know what to do with it. Whereas this at least means something to the Internet Explorer because it knows what to do with these tags. Okay? But so the point I'm trying to make here is that these are content tags, but at the same time, just because you call them content tags doesn't mean that there is wide-ranging agreement that author means the following thing. Okay, because somebody else may have written the same exact bibliography entry saying writer begin, writer end. And then a third guy has to come and say that authors and writers are the same. Okay? But the advantage here, one advantage here, as I said, is the self-describing, the data here this is really a data syntax standard where the table names, if you're coming from the database side, the table attribute names are inlined with the data. Okay? And if it's inlined with the data, you can throw a piece on the wire and the guy on the other side can capture it and would know the structure right away without waiting for where did the top of the table go. Okay, so in one way that's basically what it means to say it's self-describing. Okay, and so in some sense, actually this is bogus. Schema info part of the data, in a sense all we are saying is that the attribute names are part of the data. Whether or not this is a valid XML document depends on what was supposed to be valid XML document, you know, according to your standard. So maybe it turns out, suppose I have a bibliography entry which has a title begin foundation, title end, title begin again, another title end, title begin again, another title end. That may not be a legal book. Maybe legal books don't have multiple titles. Legal books may have, a valid book may have multiple authors but not multiple titles. But I could have written, you know, if I'm self-describing, I can just say, here are all my titles, here are all my authors for the book. Okay? The only way you, the guy who got this element, can see whether or not this is valid according to any syntactic standard is if there was another accompanying schema information saying all valid elements must have at most one title, at least one author, and an optional price information, and so on. And if you give that information, that's the schema information, you can then compare, you can validate your data that you got with respect to the schema information and see whether or not it's valid. Okay? So it's not really that schema information is part of the data unless your schema really is relational data where all table elements have the exact same structure. And so if one element has that structure, everybody else in that table also has the same structure in the relational data. Okay. But XML does allow things where you can have optional columns, you can have multiple instances of the same element, and all this fun stuff. And so you need a separate standard. And so, in fact, for XML, there is a standard called XML schema, which we'll kind of flash briefly in a couple of slides later, which is used to describe what an XML file is supposed to contain. Syntactically speaking, that it cannot have more than one title or it can have multiple authors, all that stuff is put in that schema, right? Now what's interesting, of course, is, okay, so that's one thing, that's the schema thing. Now this stuff, why are database, in fact, if you read any database proceedings, in fact, one of the nicest things, interesting things is, the people that are most excited about XML in the academic communities are not IR folks. IR folks don't seem to write anything about XML yet. If you read SIGIR, there's very little about XML there. Okay. If on the other hand, you pick up SIGMOD or VLDB or ICDE, more than half the papers are about XML and how to handle it. And you know, I know at least some of you are part of EHN's course, right? Are any of you here a part of EHN's course? Yeah. So that whole course Professor Chen is teaching, it's on web and data, and that's all about XML, you know, a large part of it, not all. A large part of it is about XML viewed from a database angle. So I'll give you a two-slide summary of her class. So you get it free today, you know, without having taken it. But, you know, you get what you paid for. So the summary may not be particularly useful. But anyway, the reason database folks are so excited about XML is the following, you know, so there is no standard syntax at all for relational data. There's no standard syntax. Okay, we know that conceptually there are tables. Tables have columns, and columns at somewhere at the top of the column you should write the name, etc. But there's no actual standard syntax that everybody agreed on. And with XML, they have a syntax, and it's basically the self-describing tag-based syntax. You could use that. Okay, and now different databases can exchange data in the XML format. So previously they had to exchange tuples unless they have already agreed upon what the tops of their tables are. If you just get a tuple, you have no clue what to do with it, even syntactically. Meaning-wise, we still don't know. You know, we still don't know as of today. We still don't know how to deal with meaning. Okay, but it's not surprising at all that we don't know how to deal with meaning. But at least we should have some sort of a kind of, you know, agreement at the syntax level. And at least with the XML, you know, different databases can throw their tuples, you know, individual tuples when they are on the wire, they come as XML elements. XML documents, and so they can then be, you know, parsed back into whatever internal representation you have. In fact, nobody in their right mind would store data as a big XML file. Why? Because if you are talking about large tables, you know, with let's say three columns, you know, a large table with three columns, each of them is fixed precision, like, you know, maybe two-digit integer, right? Now, if you just store those integers as tuples versus for each of these, you store a big attribute name and a little integer, a big attribute name and start all over again, you're wasting a lot of space, of course. So nobody actually stores XML data in this Baroque way. But this Baroque way is useful because it's good to transfer data, individual tuples. And so that's, you can ship it over the web and input it to any application. That's a nice syntax, it's a very syntactic level standard is available. Let me just see. Okay, so this is my thing that I was going to tell you. I'm sure you already, I mean, these are the set of slides that I like most to make the point that XML doesn't have any meaning in world, except I know that at least a couple of you are already able to read that stuff, which I can't read. This is why I said this doesn't make any sense for Chinese students in this class. You know, they're already thinking that's a meaningful slide. And the rest of you don't think there's anything going on there. So assume that Chinese, forget Chinese. Maybe this is like the wrong Chinese character or something. Is it even Chinese, first of all? Or is this Japanese? I can't even tell that. Okay. Anyway, so I do suddenly realize this stuff sounds, you know, particularly interesting. But anyway, so this is a nice set of things. This is actually from Jim Handler that I stole, basically showing that XML has no connection to meaning. Okay, so a normal web page is sort of like this for a program. If it's in English, you would think that it means something to you, and so you think it means something to your program too, except those three guys who will have a separate class. For the rest of you, you know, it kind of tells you that for the program, the page doesn't mean anything. Okay, and now what we do in XML, you say name begin, blah, 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 name end. Education begin, blah, 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 education end. work begin, work end, private, private end. Is this really a CV, by the way? If you read this, does it look like a CV? I can't even tell. I'm assuming based on this. This is, you know, maybe a handler can't read. Handler obviously can't read Chinese anyway. So he just suddenly, by putting these tags, I made this look like a CV. All the English-speaking people now are thinking, oh my God, now I know what this means. This is just a CV. Yeah, this is just the name, or this is the education, this is the work, this is the private. Okay? Right? So that's the seduction of the XML. Okay? But it's not you who is running the program that's running. And for the program, these actually look like this. Again, assuming no Greeks here, right? In this class, there should be only English speaking, you know. So they look like yet another language. We have no clue what those mean. I mean, the program has no more clue as to what these tags mean than it has as to what this means. Okay, they're just tags. Okay, for the machine, the tags look like this. Now, here's the interesting thing. There are two pages which have tags in two different, I mean, fortunately, in fact, these are in the same language, but it could be that these tags are in some language, these tags are in some language. If you change the tag information, so when you start, somebody calls it author, somebody calls it writer, that's sort of like this. Now, you know, a common guy is trying to then, you need a third party who tries to kind of connect up the tags from here to the tags from here. Before you can even get to the point of saying, well, you know, that means these are all the names, and these are all the education parts, these are all the whatever else parts. Okay? Now, this is basically middle ground, where somebody else is actually comparing your schema to somebody else's schema. The tag information is schema information, in essence. And so somebody is out there trying to compare your schema to somebody else's schema. Okay, last class I was mentioning this business of Transformic, the company which essentially takes employment opportunities from multiple different sources and tries to put them in one common format. To do that, it's getting employment opportunities which look like this, and it has its own internal schema, and it needs to put them in this schema. And to do that, they need a translation between the tags at that level. Okay. So XML definitely does not mean machine accessible meaning by any stretch of imagination. Okay? To do that, you need to relate the tags. Anyway, so this goes on and on. This is basically someone else has another tag. So I guess there is still the need for mapping. Okay. Now, one way you can deal with this mapping issue is we all agree. We be good people. Okay? Let's all agree that for books, writer is the name for the author. You know, if anybody says author, they will be slapped on their face. Or whatever. We agree on one. Okay, maybe let's all agree on author. Okay? And so then we will write the bibliography data author begin, author end, etc. And we know now that the entire world's bibliography data would be in this common format. And so now you, the programmer, can go ahead and write a program which essentially attributes semantics to these tags. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so this is one way, basically here you're standardizing by consensus of some sort. Now obviously, the way this happens is on small communities, and not surprisingly, there are variations of XML that are sort of agreed upon by individual communities, which already have the standardization thrown in. And normally the way they ensure that the standard is followed is either from power or from economic considerations. Okay, if you don't use it, I'll put you in jail, or if you don't use it, nobody will be able to buy anything from you. And in fact, before XML became a standard, first of all, the idea of XML predates web, you know, because it comes from the document description language called SGML. Okay, now SGML was watered way down to get to HTML, where all tags only mean rendering information. And then it was concentrated a little bit higher up to get to XML now. Okay, so SGML was the standard which was much way before web. So now from HTML, various sub-communities have actually started making their own standard syntaxes for describing data. Okay. I think, in fact, the electronics vendors had agreed upon a very stable consensus language for describing electronics products. And that was one of the things that was used as the motivation for XML. Even before XML, there was actually an electronics vendor standard where all the elements that everybody is selling is described in some standard format. Okay, so the way this is happens now is everybody has their own little every group of homogeneous set of people who would agree and you know to live by some standard have made their own standard. Okay, so there is financial reporting markup. Business reporting markup, apparently music XML, I really wonder what that says, spacecraft markup language. So everything markup. So as long as you and I agree, so we can have exam markup language. And we all agree on what the markups are supposed to be, and we all use it. In fact, it's very easy to use because I set the exam, so I'll follow the standard. Then we'll have a standard for exam. Okay. This is how meaning is currently ensured. Everybody agrees and nobody defects. Okay. And normally the reason people don't defect is because there is a penalty. You know, for example, in electronics vendor communities, there are central places from where you can check who has what items. And if you don't put your data in the right format, then whoever is checking would not know that you have certain things to sell. Okay. So you would wonder that, you know, the same sort of thing might very well happen for shopping stuff. You know, maybe if all book vendors somehow agree to, you know, publicize their books in a particular standard of describing books, that would be a book standard. Okay. But these are all for individual sub communities, not for the entire web by any means. Okay. Yes. Yeah, but each field, everybody makes a different name for each field. See again, the problems existed even before.
The standard is something like, I mean, you're posting all the people who are writing XML documents in that particular domain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, similarly, you can have something like databases in this particular domain should have UCMs.
So you're saying, why can't we have standards at the database level? Why do we even need XML? Is that your question? Well, I think they sort of jumped on this bandwagon. I mean, there may have been such standards for specific types of databases. You know, for example, one of the issue is while relational databases cornered the market, it's not the only type of databases. And so, in fact, different types of, like if you have object-oriented databases, you need a separate standard, even at the database level. Okay. So, it's possible that there may have been small standardization efforts across small groups of people before. But now everybody is on the XML bandwagon because that seems like a reasonable syntactic vehicle in which you can define text, you can write relational data, you can also write certain types of object-oriented data because you have OID reference information. And so somehow we can talk about your standards in this arena. Okay, furthermore, the syntax of XML is really, in a sense, it's extremely loose. Anything can be put in XML, okay? And in fact, all XML standard specifications can be put in XML, okay? So XML schema is in what syntactic form? XML. What's interesting, of course, is the first version of schema for XML was in something called DTD, Document Type Definition Language, which was not in XML. Imagine how embarrassing it is. You're telling the world that everything in the world can be written in XML except the schema for XML, which has to be written in some other language. This DTD with ugly looking regular expressions and so on. So they quickly cleaned up that mess, and now they have XML schema, which just looks like XML. It's just the tags are different. You know, a tag can be any random, you know, word, phrase, whatever from English language. I mean, if you want a phrase, you put like, you know, colons or dashes or whatever, and you know, you can have that. So the space of tags is unlimited. okay? And they also have, you know, for those of you who know any of the reasonable languages, Lisp, Ada, and all these things, you know, you can have namespaces, right? If, so that you, not everybody would have the same exact author. You know, you might say, this is the class space when there is an author word, and there is, this is some other space where there is another author word. And the way you have that is you put the word of the space first, colon, and the word that you're using. And you, this can be nested. And that's basically what XML schema, for example, does. You know, there would be a reserved keyword that every, that would start every attribute name, every tag name. That's how it becomes an XML schema tag now. Okay. But the schema information, the syntax information of XML itself is basically tag begin, tag end. Okay, so one of the uses is that it's really, we're not asking for too much. We're just saying, you know, put a couple of tags in between. And that's very easy. Yeah, there was a question somewhere. Yes. From the database point of view. Again, I mean, you can have object-oriented people will take the view that they are more semi-structured than relational database people. Okay. Again, I think one of the important things is to realize that first slide where there were conflicting, I mean, there were orthogonal reasons which sort of converged onto XML. And depending on where you, how you came to XML, you may think XML is for this thing and not any other thing. Database guys think it's for one thing, the text guys think it's for another thing, and the, you know, the clueless guys think that it is for putting meaning on the web, okay? So the XML versus relational model, basically we already agreed on this, that any relational data can be written up in XML, not surprisingly, right? And it can support semi-structured, so it also can support structured data. And the way you would do is you start, I mean, there may be various ways of writing it, but one obvious way is to say table begin, tuple begin, attribute 1 begin, its value, attribute 2 begin, its value, attribute 3 begin, its value, tuple end, start tuple again. Okay? And that's, there's an obvious way of connecting, converting this thing. Now, from the relational data point of view, XML actually is more expressive syntactically because it allows you to have, for example, it allows you to have optional elements. It allows you to have multiple instances of the same element. Those are at least the minimum things that you can understand. And there are a lot more differences syntactically in terms of what can be directly represented by relational data versus what can be written in XML. This is easy. Sending from relational to XML is easy. The other way around, you tend to lose structure. If you have multiple authors, either you have to put null values, you have to put as many author columns as there are the maximum number of authors in any element, or you have to lose structure by putting them all as a list. Okay? So this is basically this. And in fact, one of the things that people say, and this is actually an interesting view to have, is that if your table has a union of multiple schemas, so suppose you actually say, I have a conceptual table of books, but it is really a union of three tables. Table 1, which is all books with just one author. Table 2, which is all books with two authors exactly. Table 3, which is all books with three authors exactly. All three of these have exact schemas, and you know which, you know, whether or not an element can be put there, and there won't be any null values. Now, all these three tables are basically represented, you know, in one fell swoop as in one single XML document. And so you can think of XML schema as supporting union, a disjunction over relational schema. So you can do multiple schemas at the same time. This is basically what I was saying earlier. This is this issue of writing the schema information for an XML document. It's not required that you give a schema information for XML document. Okay? It's, if you do give it, then somebody can check whether your XML file that came to me is syntactically correct. It may be semantically still wrong, but nobody is going to check that. Okay? If you give the syntactic, you know, if you give schema information up front, then you can write automatic validity checkers which can take the schema, take this an XML page and see whether or not it is parsed by that schema. Okay. And now, of course, the question is what would be the language you would use for the schema? And the original one, which in fact is still used in some of the web pages out there, is DTDs, which is Document Type Definition Language. And, you know, they're essentially saying a paper document contains elements, section elements contains title, again section, which is a cleanest star there, and R text, and then title is PC data, text is PC data. Okay, you can read it, you're computer science geeks, you know, you can read this stuff. This is basically a bunch of regular expressions explaining, you know, how many instances of each type of thing are allowed. Okay, and then the newer one is XML schemas, okay, which basically writes DTDs in the schema format. In a format that's in XML to begin with. Well, the DTD is not in XML, XML schema is in XML. But to put something in XML is not that hard, really. All you need to do is start, you know, make up some tags and that we agree upon and write those. Okay. So in this particular case, essentially, this is data. This is a bunch of purchase orders data. And this is a particular schema which is defining what is syntactically allowed in each purchase order. Okay, so presumably here this is the XSD, this is your package name, that's the X schema package. And then it's an element there and whose name is purchase order, it's the type is given, and then you can start writing what else is inside purchase order. Okay, so that's the standard. Again, it has a syntax, XML schema has a syntax, which is used to tell the validity checker how many instances of each thing are allowed. If there are elements which allow attribute names to occur along with the element name, what are those, you know, attribute names that are allowed? All that fun stuff you can write in there. Okay. Okay. So that's about XML schema. And so now we'll get to, and we hopefully will complete it next class, the issue of, now that you have this XML data in front of you, how would you query it? How would you do it in any different way than people were able to do before? Okay, so for example, database guys would like to at least do all the things that databases could do, plus more. They wouldn't settle for less, but they want at least all the things that they could do before. Text guys will have much lesser expectations because they couldn't do much anyway to begin with. They'll say, whatever little we could do, we should be able to do here too, plus maybe a little bit more. Okay, again, conflicting requirements because schema is not required in XML. Text people never even tell you that the following page has the following structure. They don't have to. If they give you that information, you should, you know, be very thankful to them and use it. If they don't, you don't get to sue them. Whereas in databases, if somebody gives you a table without a schema, you get to sue them. Okay? Your different type of requirement. So any querying language for XML should be able to handle data without schema information, and do better if the schema information is available. An interesting thing is, if you do have schema information available, you could do better. Because suppose I know that there is maybe at most one author, then I can devise storage approaches which will exploit that fact. Okay. So one of the interesting things that's opened by this issue is, if they don't give you schema, you learn the schema. So you look at enough number of book items and try to induce the common schema that would be satisfied by all the book elements that you have. So this is direct learning, classification learning. You have training data, right? From them you're trying to induce what must be the schema that would actually capture all this. Now what's interesting, of course, from the classification learning point of view, what's interesting about this? You have training data, right? But the training data is funny in some pretty important way. What? You don't have? Yeah. No, but I mean the category is, these are all the valid documents. These are all the valid books. What's interesting is, in a sense, you only have positive examples. You only know valid documents. There are the space of invalid documents, nobody even tells you. These are all the invalid books. If they do, it's useful. But in many cases, you know, despite the fact that classification learning makes you think that all learning occurs only when you have both positives and negatives. And in fact, there are learning algorithms which will fail flat, you know, if you only have one type of example. But machine learning in general is more general than that, and human learning too is. Okay, in fact, there are studies showing that all the things we tell kids, saying don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, that's all gobbledygook. They're not listening to you. And every once in a while they say do it, that, or you did it well, that's the only thing they're taking as training data. There are actually studies showing that. You know, of course, I think by the time you come to college, we assume that you have changed that, so we give you a lot more negative feedback rather than positive one. But in general, you know, for kids, it's all positive feedback. That's what matters. So positive examples. Here it's again a positive example. Okay. So need to support both information retrieval and SQL type queries. That's a pretty tall order. Okay. And so which actually means both ordered and unordered data. Because SQL essentially uses unordered semantics and text is inherently ordered. Okay. And it should be. This was another design decision, human readable. And, you know, we'll show you XQuery and you can decide whether it's human readable or not. But then the committee was dominated by a bunch of database people who think SQL is human readable. Okay, so you can't get any more human readable than SQL. Okay, so what are the candidates for the querying language? First, you have to come up with a query language. What should be the kind of queries we will support? And then come up with semantics for the query language. And then let it loose on the world, hope that people A, would use it, and B, would develop query processors which will take queries in that form and support running of those queries. Okay, there are bunches of candidates, and the ones that we will talk about, that one that we will talk about only because I think that's sort of more of the front runner than some of the others, is XQuery. As I said, that's my PL1 candidate. Okay, but I do want to say something about XSL. XSL is what? People might know what XSL is. Those are style sheets. What are style sheets used for? What? To do what? What is their main use for transforms?
To transform the XML into some other form.
Exactly. So in fact, that's actually, it's used for rendering. I mean, you're already taking a much better view. Original view of XSL is, you remember the book was written as author, title, all that stuff. Now you give it to IE, Internet Explorer, it'll choke on it. So before it eats it, you would say author becomes bold, okay? Title becomes italics, and something else, price becomes capitals or something, okay? And that's a transform. It's just tag to track transformation, almost. Now what is interesting is, you could act as if this is a query language in itself, because oftentimes you could say that given a bunch of book data in XML format, I might say, give me just the titles of the books and their prices. That's a query. That's a selection query for the database buffs here. Okay? And I can do that. All I need to do is I'll write an XSL transformation which basically takes those two out and ignores the rest. Okay, so it's interesting to know that actually something which was meant to be a rendering thing, you know, XSL, can also be seen as a query language. Except whenever you're talking about such query languages, the issue becomes how expressive are they? Is XSL as expressive as SQL? You know, to be able to do SQL, you have to do joins. Can you do joins with XSL? You can ask yourself that. Okay. It turns out that it is it's a four-man language. It's actually used by a lot of people, you know, currently, because nobody has really bought XQuery, hook, line, and sinker yet. Okay. So XQuery actually allows transformations, basically pattern transformations. You know, you take an XML document, change its pattern. So XQuery actually has XSL. It also has view things of SQL type, joins, selections, and so on. Okay, so you threw both in. And you are going to read XQuery syntax a little bit before you come to the next class, and I'll quickly go through some examples and then we'll continue our progress forward. Okay?